Radio EcoShock.
This speech was recorded by Alex Smith at the University of British Columbia, April 9th, courtesy of the Vancouver Institute.
Leave if you've got places to go, and if there are people with questions or comments or abuse or whatever, I'll try to repeat the questions back, in part because we're joined, I think, by a bunch of people in various places kind of online watching a webcast, so I'll repeat them and make sure they can hear too.
You give no practical prescription, and I'm sure you've been told that Canada is headed probably for a conservative majority government the next short while. That's a party that, up until about 5 or 7 years ago, refused to acknowledge global warming at all. And when they found it politically untenable, they've become environmentalists. So, given the actual reality of the political situation, how do you see resolving it in any kind of way?
Two questions here. One is, what's the practical prescription? And the other is, how do we get there politically? Look, the only lever that we have that's big enough to pull that's going to get action in the time that matters is the lever of price. We have to send a stiff signal into our economic system. We have to raise the price of carbon. We have to raise it quite a bit. We have to do that in a way that doesn't bankrupt people. The BC carbon tax is a small sense of how that might begin, but it probably needs to be designed more powerfully than that and ratcheted up faster if it's going to get anywhere. It's not going to happen politically unless we build this movement to a much larger place and do it fast. And that's the only thing that I think can make it happen, because we're not going to match. My guess is we're unlikely to match the financial power of the fossil fuel industry. I mean, I was in Calgary a few months ago, and there were skyscrapers exploding out of the soil, you know. I mean, you could almost smell the money. And that money is palpable, and it's going to carry the day unless there's a really strong movement that builds against it. And that means, you know, that means doing this kind of work at a much higher level. I don't know enough to tell you who to vote for or whatever. You'll figure that out. But the voting will be at best stage one of this. It's much more important, really, even to build that movement that can hold and push whoever is accountable. And remember that story I told you about the fact that we managed to take the quite conservative Republican in Vermont in 24 hours by producing a sufficient number of people turn their head around on precisely this question. We need that on a scale magnified many, many, many times. I wish there was some secret or easy answer or some back door through which to go. We spent 20 years hoping that we could sort of persuade elites to do this on the sly and behind closed doors. When the cap and trade vote failed in the U.S. Senate last year, that was the kind of, I think, final death knell for that, and when Copenhagen failed. That's not how this is going to get done. If it's going to get done, it's going to be by a mass movement of people demanding change. That sounds very daunting. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but one's allowed to have a little bit of optimism in this year, because we've watched people in places like Tunisia and Egypt in a matter of weeks topple tyrants who'd been there for a quarter century or more and do it entirely nonviolently and simply by the power of standing up and demanding with great courage that kind of change. They need more courage than we're going to need. No one's going to shoot you for doing this. But what we need is the determination that they brought to it. I wish there was some other way. Yes.
How does the Japanese nuclear accident in Fukushima change our picture for our energy future and what we can do about climate change?
So how does the accident in Japan and the nuclear thing change the parameters of this fight? I think not. My guess is not too much, because I don't think nuclear was ever going to be an enormous part of this solution, not so much on safety reasons, mostly because it's an unbelievably expensive way to produce power. It only happens when you give big subsidies. Most places aren't going to do that. There's only in a few countries like China are we going to see really large-scale development of nuclear power in the next 30 or 40 years. I think the main thing that what happened to Japan may have done is at some level concentrate our minds a little bit about the need to start making progress. I wrote a piece for The Guardian right the next week saying the main thing that it sort of struck me about the whole thing was just a reminder of what a narrow margin civilization actually exists on. Now, that was a natural disaster that happened in Japan, an earthquake and a tsunami, but it knocked, you know, it clearly knocked a large part of that highly civilized society over the edge very, very fast. We're reducing constantly that margin by changing the climate. We're taking that margin all the time and eroding it. And that should be, in some ways, the main lesson of Japan. And I think it probably should remind us that going forward, we do well to spend less time worrying about growth all the time and things, and more time worrying about durability and resilience and safety and security and all those sort of things as well. It was a pretty instructive moment. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how the Japanese interpret that experience.
This year there will be 7 billion people on the earth, and so the need for more food, more transportation, and so on. How can that work?
The question's about population and about the fact that we're going past 7 billion people. So one can talk about population in several different ways. I wrote a book years ago called Maybe One, a kind of argument for single-child families in the West. So population is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. It's very important. But at this point, one can talk about it in many ways as a great success story, too, for human beings. 30 years ago, the average woman on this planet had 6 children. That number now is 2.6 and continuing to fall very fast. The demographers say we're going to go from 7 billion now to about 9 billion at the middle of the century. And then our human population will plateau and begin to drop. It's not going to double again or anywhere close to it. And the reason for that is that people got their act together. We figured out, not we so much, people in the developing world figured out what it would take to slow down their birth rates. And what it took, to some degree, was the availability of contraception and things, but much more importantly, what it took was the education and the relative empowerment of women. And when that happened, in place after place after place, fertility, family size dropped dramatically. Now, you know, 9 billion will be harder to deal with than 7, but most of that growth is coming in places that use so little energy that it's not the driver of climate change. And we forget just how vast that gulf is. The average North American family uses more energy between stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve and dinner on January 2nd than the average Tanzanian family uses in the course of a year. Okay? So the number of Tanzanians is not a significant variable when we're talking about climate change. Most of the increase right now in global warming gases, though in per capita terms they're nowhere near us, but most of the increase is coming in places like China with stable populations, but where consumption is rising towards a North American mean, you know? And it's figuring out how to alter that consumption curve now that's as important as altering the fertility curve a generation ago. We don't know quite what to do, how to do it. The hope is that putting a real price on carbon might have some of the same educational effects that putting women in school did in much of the world. Way, way in the back.
Me?
Yes.
I have a question about the 24th of September.
Yes.
We Canada Initiative is a civil society movement in the lead up to the Earth Summit 2012, working for Canadian leadership at the summit. And I would like to know what is the best way to approach 350.org to become partners and to support the 24th of September and make it a memorable one.
So
on Canadian part.
This is a great question, and thank you for asking it. And the answer is going to be at some level unsatisfying to you because, or maybe the opposite, because though 350.org has actually, you know, we actually did organize these enormous things in a sense, we're really not, we still have no money and no resources. Now those seven kids are, you know, now about 12 people around the world. And that's it. So when we do these kind of things, we don't really organize them. We have a potluck supper ourselves, you know. We say what the date is and kind of what the theme is so that everybody's on the same. But then it's up to everybody to figure out what to do. So you will know so much better what to do all across Canada. So maybe, you know, Vancouver, I can tell just by driving around and looking at things, Vancouver's become a bike city, you know. There are bike lanes all over the place. What a perfect day to bring in to this movement, not just the people who already understand it, but everybody who loves riding bikes. Truthfully, there are more people who enjoy riding bicycles than are obsessive about global warming at the moment. And you can make them part of this for a day. You know, it'll be a huge and beautiful day. There's lots of other things that can be going on, you know, in place after place. And you will know best. So if you go to 350.org and I'll... You email me at bill@350.org and I'll connect you up with people. As soon as you figure out what to do, you can register it and we can start sending everybody in that we get from your part of the world in your direction and on and on and on, and it'll be terrific. And you guys are the thing that we discovered around the world, and this is the really good news, is that absolutely everywhere there are people completely capable of doing this everywhere. And all that they need is a kind of assurance that other people are doing the same thing at the same time, so it'll have enough oomph to matter, you know. And so thank you so much in advance, and I can't wait to see what the pictures look like that come back on September 24th.
Can you speak to the role of civil disobedience in this movement?
Yes, I could. We're going to need more of it, I'm afraid. Because, oh, the question was, can I speak to the role of civil disobedience in this movement? And look, we need ways to illustrate the moral urgency of the situation that we're in. And one of the ways we do that is you know, through the set of tactics that Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others taught us over the last century, one of the great inventions in many ways of the last century. In their way, I think, will be of longer value and more interest than the other inventions like cracking the atom or whatever of the last century. Now, that said, it's very hard to, you know, civil disobedience is a double-edged sword and it's easy for it to cause more trouble than help. If we're going to do it, well, I'll tell a story I told yesterday. I organized 2 years ago, just about 2 years ago this month, the first big civil disobedience thing in the U.S. on climate. And we did it, we almost couldn't help but do it because the U.S. Congress, it turns out, has its own power plant. Two blocks away from the beautiful Capitol is this incredibly grimy, hulking old thing that's been there for 115 years burning coal. And we thought it should not be burning coal. And so a few of us, the great American writer, my favorite American writer of all, Wendell Berry, the wonderful farmer essayist, he and I sent out a letter and said, come to Washington, we were going to sit in outside this power plant and try to get it closed down. And since we didn't have any real idea what we were doing, it worked somewhat better than really it should have. We had thought that 500 people would come until we'd reached an agreement with the police that they would arrest 500 people and it would all be, but 5,000 people came, and so the police said, we can't arrest anybody, we don't have that many cells. But it didn't matter because Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, who ran in those days the House and the Senate, said, okay, we'll shift it off coal. And so it's, you know, one down, 600 to go. But the key thing, and here's the point I want to make about civil disobedience. We were thinking hard as we did this, how not to give the usual picture, which is, you know, a bunch of kind of raggedy folks angry at everything and it's looking threatening and kind of nutty and whatever else. So we said, if you want to come to this, you only can come, we don't allow you to come, unless you're wearing your Sunday best. So if you're not in a dress or in a necktie, we don't want to see you. And the reason was that we wanted to get across the point visually, as well as anything else, that we're not the radicals in this scenario. There's nothing radical about what I'm told you tonight. Just the opposite. The radical proposition is, let's pour a lot of carbon into the atmosphere until the atmospheric composition that's worked for the last 10,000 years is completely shifted, and just see what happens. That's crazy, okay? That's radical at the most root level. If there was ever, no one ever thought, if the Soviet Union had been doing that secretly, if they'd had like secret carbon dioxide factories, we would have bombed the hell out of them, you know? That's completely radical. We needed a way to say, in this instance, really, we're kind of the conservatives, you know? We're trying to preserve the Earth in something like the form in which we found it, a basic conservative task. So I think that as we do civil disobedience, that, and one of the ways that we're going to try to do that, I hope if we do more of it, and we will be doing more of it, at least in the States, is make sure that if we do civil disobedience this time, it is not college kids who are the only cannon fodder for this project, okay? It's not fair, because A, they still have, you know, resumes to fill out and jobs to get, and B, because they haven't been pouring carbon into the atmosphere for 50, 60, 70 years like some of us, you know? I told a story this morning to someone about the first time I got arrested on this. It was the first climate sort of civil disobedience of any kind in the U.S. And it was some years ago, and there was a wonderful woman, a 90-year-old woman. She walked across the United States when she was 90, 5 miles at a time as a protest about this stuff. And she was going 5 miles at a time because she had emphysema and because she was 90 years old, okay? 3 years later, she was on the cover of Time, so she was very effective. But 3 years later, she called me up, said, come to Washington, we're having a protest. And you know, I knew it was not going to change the world, this protest. But when someone who's 93 tells me to do something, I generally do it, you know. And so I went, and we held a little sign, stop global warming, stop campaign contributions from global warmers. And we held it in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. And that's too close, apparently, because they arrested us. And they handcuffed the two of us together. And it was very funny, because she was like 4'8", okay? And like this, you know? And she looks up at me in her emphysema voice. She said, you know, she said, I'm 93, never been arrested before, should have started long ago. So I was like, I don't know if you all need to get arrested, all right? But that's the kind of spirit that we require if we're going to get anywhere on this. Good question.
Yeah, speaking of getting anywhere, if the money of the oil industry wins the day, do you see any hope for all the various plan Bs that are out there, like sequestering, you know, geoengineering in general?
So are there kind of fallback plans like sequestering carbon beneath or geoengineering the planet? There are scientists talking about how we might do this stuff, but it's all so far in the realm of science fiction, and it all comes with enormous drawbacks. So maybe we could, having filled the atmosphere with carbon and increased the temperature, the most common sort of fallback plan that some scientists are envisioning is maybe we could also fill the atmosphere with enough sulfur to block incoming solar radiation. Okay, and it might, you can sort of do the math where it might work if you kind of constantly fly this stream of jets up into the atmosphere and dump sulfur, if you fire artillery shells all the time with sulfur into the atmosphere. But A, you know, the sky turns a nice milky white. B, you've got sort of acid rain falling. C, the ocean is still turning to acid anyway. And D, to the extent that we can even model these kind of things on computers, it looks like these side effects are almost as bad as the disease. Like potentially or quite likely you manage to move the monsoon off off the Asian subcontinent. At which point, you know, I mean, there's only 2 billion people or so who depend on it for dinner. These are break-the-glass solutions, okay? We might do well to research some of them in case everything goes kaflooey, but I used to run a homeless shelter, so I spent a lot of time with junkies. This is the kind of logic that junkies bring to problems, okay? And we'd probably be smart to try and, like, deal with the underlying cause, would be my guess. Peter, I don't want to hold people here beyond their... do we have time for one more question? Okay. There you go.
I just wanted to suggest that we start an organization called 350.org where we all email in and become members. And then if people want to get a body of like-minded people near them to do a demonstration, political demonstration, they can somehow be connected and email those people. And so that's one idea. And then we could, you know, whether it's signing petitions or doing demos or just distributing tips and information to those people who really care about this. The other point I wanted to make or just mention is that recently we've heard that water is going to become, with this tendency to global warming, the most precious commodity we have on Earth. And that's something we have to think about. And I've been told by someone who flies all over the world how we have the tar sands here in Canada, but apparently in the Middle East, they also, in their oil fields, have these big, enormous funnels or chimneys that are just spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So how do we address that? The other question I had was... care to touch on, Monsanto is a great threat to our farmers here in North America and elsewhere in the world for producing genetically modified or diverse crops.
Let's deal with these in order. We've actually already started this thing called 350.org, and you can sign up and it works great, and it works just the way you describe. And if people here sign up, they'll we'll be able to connect you all easily within Vancouver, and it'll be great. Look, the tar sands are not the only problem we've got, and the Middle East is, you know, producing a lot of oil, and there's a lot of coal in the U.S., especially up in the there's six or eight of these great deposits of carbon around the world, and we've got to figure out how to deal with all of them. But you know what? Y'all don't worry about the Middle East for time being. We'll get people to work on it, you know? You guys, if you guys take care of Alberta, okay, we'll take care of the rest. And the final question, just about agriculture in general. Look, Monsanto and all the other big agricultural players, the only way that we're going to deal with those kind... I mean, the reason that we have industrial agriculture on the scale that we do is because we have cheap fossil fuel. The only way that we will really change our agricultural systems or many of our other systems on a large scale is by putting a price on fossil fuel to make it reflect the damage that it does in the atmosphere. When that happens, that's the day that we will see a begin of a real decline in industrial agriculture and a real and deep and powerful resurgence in the kind of local and highly productive agriculture that holds some hope for feeding a world that's dealing with these kind of problems. So I thank you all enormously for bearing with me.